The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is the Mini Science Weekly for June the 30th. We've been busy preparing a special booklet and podcast all about the Large Hadron Collider this week, but even so, we thought we'd better fill you in on some of the other science stories making headlines. Here with me in the pod are The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and Nell Bowes of The Guardian's arts team. So without further ado, team, take it away.
News Jack.
Scientists in California have explained why Mars has such wildly differing landscapes in its northern and southern hemispheres. Teams at MIT, Caltech and UC Santa Cruz have found that huge asteroids struck the planet at an angle of 30 to 60 degrees 4 billion years ago. The resulting impact unleashed an explosion equivalent to 100 billion gigatons of TNT and created a scar 10,000 kilometres long and 8,500 kilometres wide, the largest impact crater known anywhere in the solar system.
The author of an influential British government report that says the world needs to spend just 1% of its wealth tackling climate change has warned that the cost of averting disaster has now doubled. Lord Stern published his headline-grabbing report in 2006 and warned countries needed to spend a tiny percentage of their GDP to stop greenhouse gases rising to dangerous levels. But speaking in London last week, Stern said evidence that climate change was happening faster than previously thought meant that emissions need to be reduced even more sharply.
Security at British laboratories working with some of the world's deadliest pathogens is being undermined by a lack of investment and poor maintenance, according to a report by MPs. They said some of the labs were so dilapidated there was a risk of an incident similar to last year's escape of foot and mouth virus from the Animal Health Laboratory at Pirbright in Surrey. The committee singled out the Health Protection Agency's laboratory at Porton Down in Wiltshire for particular criticism. The facility, which handles anthrax, hemorrhagic fever and pox viruses, was declared so run down that it was not acceptable that scientists were asked to work there.
And finally, a British-built steam car was unveiled this week. It hopes to smash the longest-standing land speed record for steam vehicles. The vehicle aims to beat Fred Marriott's record of 128 miles an hour, which was set in 1906. Charles Burnett III will drive the car later this year. And, never mind the speed, the car generates enough heat to make 23 cups of tea a second.
Let's pick up on those. I'm going to ask Nell while we wait to work out how she got the 23 cups of tea a second. It was just written down, she'll argue. But,
let her work it out.
Ian, Mars. Now, this Mars north-south divide thing, this dichotomy in inverted commas, I didn't even know Mars had one. Tell us the history of this.
Well, this was discovered back in the mid-1970s when the Viking probes landed on Mars. And what they found was that in the north, you've got this enormously smooth expanse. I mean, it's actually kind of a basin, but it's actually one of the smoothest surfaces you'll find on a planet in the solar system. But if you go around to the southern hemisphere, it's all mountains going up to sort of miles high and very jagged. And so this Mars-Martian dichotomy has been, why on earth is it that the north is so smooth and the south is so jagged and rugged? Well, this is actually the group of the work of three groups, MIT, Caltech and UC Santa Cruz. What the team came up with was this idea that an enormous asteroid smacked into Mars very early on, something like a half to three quarters, maybe a bit larger, the size of our own moon, slammed into it and removed a heck of a lot of the northern hemisphere. And now if you look at Mars, you see that the north has this thinner crust there. And it's basically scar tissue what's been remained there. And it's taken a while. I mean, I think why it's been quite difficult to see this before is that a lot of this northern region, there has been volcanic activity there in the past and it's been disrupted a bit. But if you strip away all of that and look at what's going on the surface using various instruments to look at the crust and so on, you can see this enormous elliptical gouge taken out, which looks like the largest impact crater anywhere known.
Nell, do you get worried about asteroid impacts?
No, we'll just have gravitational tractors by then and be fine. I'll just pull them away.
Whatever they are, yes.
But I was kind of interested in, Ian, were they using recent data from kind of all the recent Mars probes in the past couple of years, or were they just simply using better modelling?
So they had a combination of stuff. So they were using some of the really recent maps created of Mars, and most of these were looking at what was going on with the crust. They were able to tease out what must have happened with the crust and such like an awful long time ago and what happened from geological processes later. So you're almost doing a subtraction. You're taking out what happened geologically to show what the surface would have looked like way before that all happened. And that's when you really reveal the extent of this gouge, so you can actually simulate what the terrain looked like then. So one of the teams did that, and then two other teams were actually modeling what kind of asteroid impacts. And so you're looking at the size, the mass, the speed, and the angle that it hits at. What kind of scenarios could have come about that would have given you those that kind of scarring, if you like? So they're all working sort of in league with each other, if you like, and you know, coming to a pretty good consensus on it.
Let's move on to something a bit more serious for us. This idea that government labs dealing with horrific pathogens are not very well maintained. I mean, the story last year, which you alluded to in the news jam, was of Purbright Lab. This is an animal health lab, and a leak there caused an outbreak of foot and mouth disease in England last year. So how dangerous are all these labs carrying things like Ebola and hemorrhagic fever and pox and all this sort of stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, what this report did after this accidental release from the Purbright lab of foot and mouth last year, which obviously caused an enormous amount of economic damage. I mean, farmers lost millions, obviously livestock were slaughtered and such like. But this committee then looked at all the other labs which are looking after and licensed to work on some of these really hardcore diseases and bacteria. And they found a few, and the one they highlighted was this Health Protection Agency lab at Porton Down, where they said it's so run down that you have to start asking questions as to whether that's undermining the kind of the biosecurity of the place. And so although the report was saying everything looks fine in terms of these people know what they're doing and they haven't had any accidental escapes, it's so underinvested. I mean, one of the MPs described it to me as a 1960s school building that looked like it had 40 years of kids going in and out of it. So underinvested in that you just wouldn't be surprised if something came out of there sooner or later. And this is nasty stuff that they've got there. I mean, you know, anthrax is one among a dozen or so.
Do we know if any of the scientists involved have actually made any issue about this? Because when you have new labs like this going up and at Imperial College or wherever, the security measures, they always go on about how secure it all is and the double airlocks and all that kind of stuff. To have the government's own labs like so underinvested, I mean, have the scientists themselves must know this is an issue?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of these people have been promised redevelopment. And so, you know, it's always been, yeah, we'll try and sort your lab out. But there's a real divide among the quality of the buildings and the infrastructure of government labs, depending on who is funding them. And if you literally across the road from the HPA lab, the Health Protection Agency lab at Porton Down, is the lab that everybody actually thinks of as Porton Down, which is a DSTL lab, the government military lab, which has an awful lot of its own nasty chemicals and biological sort of warfare agents under lock and key in there as well. And that place is phenomenally high tech and incredibly good. And it's just a completely tale of two worlds going on there. Some of these are run down because the HPA one is just underinvested because the Department of Health is not backing it up.
So what's the plan? I mean, now the report has come out, what will anything change?
Well, this is a report from a government committee. That report has gone to MPs now, to ministers. The ministers will have to work out what to do about this. Now, what doesn't bode well is that the redevelopment of Purbright after the leak of foot and mouth last year, that was a decision made quite quickly after that leak that we have to sort this lab out. But there are still huge arguments going on over who's going to pay for it. And so you have one government department on one side and one of the research councils just arguing who's going to pay for this. And you know, this is obviously all delays it. And so does that bode well for, you know, what's going to happen at Porton Down? Probably not. These things are just too serious not to have proper creatures and proper labs.
You know what worries
you
most about this, however, you know, in a sort of personal way, which is that we are moving to King's Cross, of course, and there will be a Category 4 lab and almost across the road from us.
Really?
Very soon, yeah. The British Library and International Science Centre, which is going to be between King's Cross and St Pancras. We're going to be 10 minutes walk from probably one of the most advanced sort of scientific
Excellent.
Labs in the world.
Anthrax for lunch.
And and our new office in King's Cross will be at this nerve centre of this sort of academic powerhouse. Mm. I mean, there is a bit of a danger, isn't there, though, Ian? I mean, on a serious note, that you have Category 4 viruses and pathogens in the middle of London, especially where next to King's Cross Station, where it could be distributed very easily on
very
trains,
swiftly on across Europe.
This issue was dealt with really delicately in this report, actually, because when the committee was taking evidence over, you know, the months it takes to do these things, they interviewed the guy who chairs the government's advisory panel, basically, on dangerous pathogens. He initially said in his evidence, I would try and find somewhere else to put one of these labs other than a densely populated urban area. He then came back and kind of qualified that statement, saying, well, but if you did, it'd probably be okay and such like. The report actually comes out and says they don't object to one of these labs going in central London. And there already are labs which have this kind of thing in central London, but the full list and location of all the labs carrying this stuff is kept secret by DEFRA. So we know a few of them, like we know Porton Down, there's a couple there, and they're all in the southeast. This one would be very, very public. Everybody would know where it is. It's between the British Museum and King's Cross. I mean, it's going to be a very new, you know, shiny new building. You know, it would be a very easy target, put it that way.
And on that note, Nell, you want to ask something?
Yeah, I want to get real frivolous again and say and ask Ian about the Odyssey story that was around this week.
Mm.
Something they've pinpointed an eclipse in the Odyssey.
Something quite close to Nell's heart here. Some nice Greek mythology. Settle in, guys.
I really like this story, and I think I like it probably because I like the Odyssey, but there are so many caveats with this story that it's hard to talk about it briefly. But essentially, the summary is there's been a bit of conversation in the community, I suppose, whoever they are, that the day that all the suitors are slaughtered by Homer when he comes, by Odysseus, when he comes back and reveals himself and takes them on and kicks ass.
Do we need a bit of background here for anyone who's not read the Odyssey? I mean,
Odysseus goes off to the Trojan War, fights, has a long journey home, eventually turns up, Penelope's waiting for him.
Leaves his wife at home for an awfully long time, so... You know,
and by the time he turns up, there's a load of chaps ensconced in the dining hall.
So he comes back, teams up with his son Telemachus, slaughters them all, and you know. And anyway, in the
Telemachus, I believe it's Sorry,
I prefer it that way. There's reference in the book to the sun blotting out the sky on the day this happens, and people have said, oh, maybe there was an eclipse. That's a bit tricky to sort of really believe because it was said by someone who was indoors at the time and no one else seems to have noticed it. So it's a bit flaky and it might have just been used as a, you know, a sort of literary device. So what these guys did was they thought, okay, well, the other bit of it is that some people a long time ago, 1920s, found out that there was indeed a very full solar eclipse on April the 16th, 1178. So
1178 BC.
Yes, sorry, 1178 BC, yeah, of course. So what these guys did, okay, we know there was an eclipse around this kind of time. We know that there's a kind of reference in the Odyssey to an eclipse. Let's go and see if there are any other references in the text to astronomical sort of heavenly body movements. And we'll try and look at those and see if they point to what the moon would have been doing on the night of the day of the slaughter. And so they found three other references, basically. They found that, you know, as Odysseus comes into harbour, that Venus is visible in the sky, and also when he sets out, even there are a couple of constellations in certain positions, and there's also a new moon on the day of everything happening, and you need a new moon for this for a solar eclipse to happen. And what they did is they worked back through using this enormous sort of computer cruncher to find where the positions of the bodies, you know, the stars and the constellations would have been, and fitted them in, and then looked ahead to see what day the deaths of all the, you know, the slaughter would have occurred on. And it occurred on this exact date, the 16th of April, 1178 BC. And so they're saying, look, even if the story is completely made up and all the rest of it, the astronomical events in this book seem consistent. And that's kind of begs more questions than it answers. Well, I think it's really interesting.
Given that we've got the written version of the Odyssey happening an awful long time after the actual
exactly.
events.
Exactly. How would they have known?
And this is done.
Maybe someone wrote it down or passed on a story.
Yeah, but it would have had to have been passed on by like oral tradition. People would have had to have remembered, you know, the positions of these stars.
And besides,
miles
the idea
away
of Venus being, you know, of seeing Venus when you come into port or whatever is surely far more of a literary device than anything else. If you're
so, are we saying?
Of course.
Are we saying now that you don't believe this piece of research?
I guess what I'm saying it's.
I have to say, the authors themselves are extremely cautious about what they're saying.
An interesting use of one's time, perhaps, back. And
one of the astronomical events they actually looked at was something they interpreted as the movement of Mercury. But it was actually in the book, it's talking about Hermes going to and fro. And they're saying that's the most tentative of their sort of interpretations. And I said, asked them, well, if you take that out, what are you left with? And they said, well, they're left with 9 dates that could have been the big sort of slaughter date, and one of them being the the eclipse date. So it isn't robust. Let's face it.
But I think it's test out your constellations after they're fine. But if you want to really make a point about literature,
doesn't it tickle your sort of desire for to sort of know a bit more about these ancient myths? The fact that actually maybe there was some watching of the skies and all that kind of stuff going on. There's something quite nice about it, isn't there?
I love it. I mean the whole. Yeah, the Odyssey is just phenomenal, and just when the seers have this vision, when they sit down and the seer tells them that they'll sit down and they're eating and their food becomes spattered in blood and everything like that, and there's so many ominous sort of symbols in the story that I love it, and I don't think this story really.
I think you can enjoy it without solid scientific background.
Bring something extra to it.
Of course it does. What about all those this sort of revisionist literature, history, science story thing where you even get them in paintings and stuff? What was it? The Munch's Scream? They thought that was definitely, there was definitely some sort of star constellation or something.
Well, that's close enough that there's something interesting.
No, fine. But I just quite like the fact that there was obviously some reality behind all of this stuff. Anyway. We'll leave classical Greek mythology there. You can read, obviously, more about all of that stuff at guardian.co.uk/science. But one thing that we should raise before we finish this half-assed podcast, I don't know if that rhymed, actually. The reason for all of this short podcast this week is the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which, obviously, you can hear all about in a special program that is also on the iTunes feed as we speak. But, Ian, you've got a quick news update on the LHC.
I don't know if you've been following this, but there are a couple of guys who've been trying to sue CERN for building the LHC and really to try and stop them throwing the switch because of all the sort of the media attention that's been given to this potential disaster scenario where they throw the switch and it creates any one of a number of disastrous sort of particles from black holes to strangelets, which consume the planet.
It's a worrying thought.
Yeah, so these guys got together, and I say one of them's a retired radiation expert from Hawaii, and the other guy's a Spanish science writer, and we know how reliable they are. But they I'm not the Spanish side, I have to say, and glad they did so well in the Euro 2008. But the science writer side of it, absolutely. And anyway, the US government has essentially said we need to throw out this this lawsuit.
That's remarkable.
What I love about it is it's not only because they want to throw it out because it's overly speculative and not very credible. They're saying it's too late anyway. And the reason they're saying it's too late is that ideally, if anybody wanted to sue, they should have sued at the time the US government started pouring money into CERN and the LHC. And essentially, they put about £250 million in, and it's already been spent. And so they're saying, look, if you had had a problem with this, you should have told us earlier. And there were precedents.
Now it's ready to go.
Yeah. And, we have precedents for this kind of issue. I mean, the whole particle collider going to destroy the Earth was raised by a previous collider up in Brookhaven. So this is just a more powerful one that maybe ups the odds a little bit. But I just thought it was quite interesting that someone had even attempted to sue CERN and try and make them not switch it on.
Well, as if suing CERN was going to be the best way of getting them not to throw the switch. Seems an odd approach.
Also in America. I mean, I know the Americans are powerful, but they don't have jurisdiction in Geneva, do they?
Yeah, well, I suppose they just wanted to try and I don't know what I'm I don't want to guess
what
their real...
Do they get some monetary compensation if everything goes tits up?
I think they probably made a sort of a strangely proof sign saying told you so.
It doesn't really matter very much,
does it?
If the world has been swallowed up
promise them a million
hole.
Quid.
But just say, look, you can have this suit.
You can have the world's global
output of coal or something.
If it all goes
well, the point that if listeners want to know why the black holes and things that might be created at LHC probably won't be so disastrous. You can read Michio Kaku's article in the special supplement. It'll be out with The Guardian on Monday. In fact, it's probably Monday already. In fact, it is Monday already. So you'll have it. Or you can go to guardian.co.uk/science/CERN. And in that supplement, there's all sorts of other interesting people, including A.C. Grayling, Martin Rees. There's also Stephen Hawking and the satirist Chris Morris when he went around CERN. So do look forward to that. This week's Science Weekly, by the way, has been produced by Ben Green. Not that he's had a great deal to do, by the way. I'm Alok Jha, and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.